I get it. You didn't click the link to listen to ads, so I'll be quick. I love coaching clinics. Whether I'm speaking at one or simply just attending, I love listening to coaches talk about how they do things while having the opportunity to connect with new coaches. At the same time, I have been able to connect with coaches all over the world through apps like Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And so many times I've had conversations with coaches and thought, I wish I could share this with other coaches. But then I had another thought. In the year 2020, why should a coach have to wait a couple months for the next great coaching clinic? If they're eager to learn, why can't we just put content at their fingertips? So we created the Film Room. The Film Room is our online education system for coaches that is designed to have everything in one place, from individual skill development and team drills to set plays and offensive and defensive systems. Our platform is a one-stop shop for coaches of all levels. And best of all, it's free with literally no strings attached. For more information, visit basketballcatalyst.com/filmroom. With all the negativity, and rightfully so, coming out with the COVID-19 virus, I do want to start the podcast off by talking about something that has been incredibly impactful in my life, and that's been the power of social media. You know, my career, my business is run in large part to the success of things like Twitter and Instagram, but through a time like this where we're going through a global pandemic, it has been so much fun to connect with players that I otherwise never would have connected with. By posting workouts and other like informational content, I've connected with a ton of coaches that are sending out my content and the content other trainers are putting out to their teams directly, and they're sending messages and saying thank you, which has allowed the opportunity to start dialogue with them, doing some coaches virtual happy hours, doing things like that. It's been really cool to see the basketball community come together. Having spent time coaching at the college level and now switching over to training, I get caught up, I think, in those groups of people, the college coaches, the trainers, but to be able to connect with more youth coaches and then high school coaches all over the country that are looking for content, that to me has been incredibly fun. Even had a coach, I believe, in Maine tag Shane Hennon and myself on Twitter and talked about how he's an old school coach, an old school five-star guy that we've really been pushing and challenging him. And he thanked us for either directly or indirectly impacting the next generation of basketball players, which absolutely blew me away. I've been able to connect with an NBA assistant coach who is like a lot of normal people, has a couple kids at home that are looking for workouts within this quarantine, and he found our stuff. And so to be able to connect with people like that, it's been an incredibly tough and incredibly difficult time for a lot of people, but I'm thankful because we're learning something through this. And so it's, at least I'm learning something through this. It is my hope that you are able to do the same. Today we have on Mike Brusewitz. Mike plays professional basketball overseas. He just got back from playing in Lithuania, had kind of a crazy end to his season. A lot of you will recognize or remember that name, Mike's name, from his time at the University of Wisconsin, his crazy hair, known as just kind of being the aggressive, spitfire, in-your-face personality on and off the floor. Mike is a great interview. He's got a ton of perspective on how this virus and the economy kind of globally is going to impact professional basketball for next year, and his thoughts on impacting local basketball, local players in Minnesota when he returns in the summer. Awesome interview and awesome guy. So without anything more, here's Mike Brusewitz. All right, we're on with Mike Brusewitz. Mike, you know, we've talked a little bit earlier this week about just kind of the crazy stuff that's going on. You just got back from overseas, kind of a crazy ending to your season where everything was up in the air and then just, whoop, it was done. So kind of tell me a little bit about how your season ended.
So my season was challenging from start to finish. I actually started my season in Greece this year, and I got cut from that job, or fired, as we should say, from that job right around Christmas time. They chose a different power forward than me. Didn't really make a lot of sense. Me and the coach didn't get along. So for better or worse, I cut the contract with them and moved to Lithuania. So that's where I was from Christmas break, pretty much Christmas time, till up until 2 weeks ago. And it was a challenge because when I showed up, it was one of the, you know, second to last place team in Lithuania. And we didn't win a game for the first 2 months I was there. We had blown four double-digit fourth quarter games the whole time. Nice. I was there.
Nice.
Oh yeah, it was great. So I was in great spirits. Plus, I was in a village in Lithuania. When I say a village, it's about 6,000 people. Like, there was one cafe, one pizza spot, and like the go-to place to go eat was a kebab stand that also did sushi, where it was literally in like this row of like, think of like small elf houses that only had window stores.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that was where I was at. And we had kind of figured out that like some of this coronavirus stuff was starting to get pretty serious, and leagues around us had gotten shut down. And this was also, we had a day off. Mm-hmm. So leagues around us had gotten shut down. This is also all the Big Ten or all the NCAA tournaments were getting, the conference tournaments were all getting shut down, and leagues around us were getting suspended. Ukraine had already canceled their league. Sweden had already canceled the league. So I was looking at this like, oh, I might not have a job in a couple of days.
Yeah, the inevitable.
And yeah, the inevitable. And then what happened was, is there was a league meeting for us on a Friday. So we had practice because we were supposed to play on a Sunday. So we had practice Friday morning. It was just weights and some shots. And all of us are sitting in the locker room waiting for this league vote to go. And about 40 minutes after we finish practice, we get the go ahead of saying, yeah, the league's canceled. The team's called, what's it called, force majeure, or an act of God. So they were basically saying they could cut all the contracts and they didn't have to pay anybody out on top of canceling the season. So it was, it was crazy. So this was Friday at about noon. And we decided to have a team party that night, and they were working on having negotiations with our team in terms of what we're going to do contractually, as well as getting me a flight back to the United States. So this all happened on Friday afternoon. We had our team party. It was a good time. The next morning we come in, and our coach had gotten real drunk the night before. So he, and not saying I didn't have a few drinks because it was the end of the season, but I was like, oh, I know I have to go in and negotiate a contract with these guys. My coach showed up an hour and a half late to our negotiation meeting. And I was like,
it's an odd negotiation tactic.
And he's drunk. Like, he is drunk in this meeting, no doubt about it.
Uh-huh.
And he was just like, oh, coffee's great. Oh, it's super interesting. So we, you know, I sit there and tell them, no, pay me my full contract, everything like that. And then they're like, all right, we'll discuss the contracts later. We didn't actually come to an agreement. And then they found me a flight the very next day. So I had to leave out the very next morning. So I had to pack all my stuff and get out of, you know, Lithuania and get to the capital city called Vilnius, because that's where we were flying out of. So it was me and another guy named Daniel Amigo, guy who played at Denver, big dude. So we had just – it was crazy for him because we had just picked him up 2 weeks before.
Yeah.
So he flew to Lithuania for 2 weeks. And, and since then we flew back. We had no complications, thankfully. But, you know, the flight back was interesting. You know, when we went through security at JFK, it was somebody pointed a temperature gun at us, at our forehead, and then they handed us a piece of paper and said, all right, go home. And it was like, you should probably self-quarantine for 14 days. Mm-hmm. You should stay out of large crowds, everything like that. And I was like, that was it. That was our spiel to detect if anybody has us. All right, sounds good.
That's crazy. You know, I've talked to a handful of guys that are kind of coming back, you know, talk to your college teammate, Jordan Taylor, and he was, you know, trying to figure out what he was going to do. Cause there's so many things that I want to touch on that come up with something like, you know, an act of God clause where you're trying to figure out, hey, do I stay here? Jordan was like, I have to stay here so that I can get paid. You have all that stuff kind of going on. But one thing that I do want to talk about is, you know, you get the temperature check I talked to a couple other guys, Ryan Brueggemann. They didn't really do much to him when he came back from Spain, and he was actually in the air on his flight when Spain declared a state of emergency. And obviously we know what has happened in Spain, unfortunately, but just thought it was crazy. I'm like, hey, so Ryan, what did they say to you? And he's like, nothing, you know, just kind of go home. So it's just kind of crazy. I know Jordan Reaver went, he was at my place, drove him to the airport. He flew to Australia. He was there for like 10 days and now he's back. He got over there and as soon as he landed, they suspended the league. But I'm not sure exactly what they did for him for quarantine, but what are you doing right now?
So for me, I kind of saw the writing on the wall, and my brother works pretty high up in the government, and he's kind of told me what's going on with this. He actually lives out in DC area, so he's always on top of this stuff. So he told me early, you know, this is going to get really bad, and please take this seriously. And you know, I look up to him. So when he told me that, I was, yeah, all right, let's make sure we take this pretty seriously. And,
yeah.
I, you know, basically on Friday afternoon, I think it was the 11th or 12th, I lost my job and called my parents up and said, you know, this is what's happening. And I, you know, I was going to not go home. We were kind of figuring out what to do. My parents were like, you can go out to Litchfield and I can quarantine in that house. And I was like, I don't really want to be around my parents. They're a little bit older.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, thankfully for them, they took care of me and they're like, we got you an Airbnb house in St. Paul. And, when you show up, it'll be stocked with food. I have a car. My parents just dropped it off at the house here and set everything up. So all I did was just fly back to Minnesota, got in an Uber and came straight to a nice house here in St. Paul, kind of by Schmidt Brewery. And, I've been sitting here by myself for 2 weeks almost.
Crazy. So,
I've been, you know, I've been, it's interesting. Like if a person who's built for this is definitely somebody who's played overseas.
Yeah.
You know, I've lived in Lithuania. I lived in a tiny town in Lithuania, and that's actually the second small town in Lithuania I've lived in the last 2 years. So I kind of know what this meditated isolation happens. This is a little more extreme because I can't even go talk to anybody else. It's all FaceTime.
Yeah.
And it's also strange because I'm in Minnesota. And I have so many friends and people I know. I was like, usually when I land, I'm, hey, let's go. Let's have lunch with as many people as I can. Let's see a bunch of people. And I can't even go say hi or give a hug to my parents because I'm just like, all right, let me just relax for a minute. But yeah, it's been an interesting couple of weeks playing a lot of video games. Had some friends reach out. I sent you a picture of my lovely genie pants and scarf. I don't care. You can totally add that to whatever you want. I got my cool UV blue glasses, blue blocking glasses on. I'm trying to stay sane out here. It's difficult. But after this 2 weeks, like on Sunday, I'm going to go out to Litchfield and stay with my parents. So it'll be a little better. I'll have some contact with them. And, you know, somewhat of a more normal interaction with human beings again will be very nice.
I had a conversation with, You probably played, Drake Dobbs came to a couple runs last year. He's a senior at Eden Prairie High School. I was talking to his dad. His dad's a pastor at a church in Eden Prairie. I said, you know, when we come back and everyone's allowed to meet in big groups, you should just do a video at the beginning of church where you interview people and they talk about the craziest thing that they did to help with their, like, keep their sanity. Like,
yeah.
And I was talking to Brad Davison. And he's like, dude, I just flip back and forth between the news channels to see like who says something crazier so I can laugh. I was like, dude, I did a ball handling workout in our parking garage and some guy walked by and told me that this is just that the coronavirus doesn't really exist, that this is just a way to shut down the economy so that they can insert a form of digital currency. And I actually stood there and had the conversation with him because I'm that bored of not being around people.
You got nothing else.
I'm like,
you got nothing else. You can't say like, oh, I have a thing to do.
Yeah.
You don't have anything to do.
Dude, we've been doing these coaches roundtables on Thursday, and I had to leave yesterday because I had to go film some stuff for my online content. But we're sitting there, and there's times where, don't get me wrong, they're good, and I love doing them. But people will just like, okay, we probably should shut this down. But because we're not going anywhere. Yeah, we're not going anywhere, but literally no one in the group has anything to do.
We can drag this out.
Yeah, Troy, the guy I was just talking about, the pastor, I FaceTimed him the other day, and he sat in his truck for a half an hour. I was like, Sherry, wondering what you're doing? He's like, nah, man, we're quarantined. Like, you kidding me? He just was hanging out.
By himself. He needed some time. See, that's the interesting thing is I'm by myself, and I don't know if it's better to be by yourself or be with a bunch of little kids. Like, my brothers and sisters have all gotten married and procreated. Good for them. Yeah. So they have a lot of little kids running around. So I don't know if it'd be more entertaining or difficult to be quarantined with small children or by yourself.
Well,
I can't decide.
Troy told me, he said, did you see that video of the guy? And it was a joke, but he said, this guy goes, hey, excuse me, you've tested positive for the coronavirus. You have two choices. A, you can be quarantined with your wife and kids, or B, and they didn't even say, and he goes, B, 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 and he started, I want to go with B. It's crazy. So I don't know. My wife and I, it's going well. We have our spaces. She's working remotely. I'm working here, obviously, but it's good. I do want to talk a little bit about, the economy. From a basketball perspective, I know that, a lot of people don't necessarily understand what goes into life overseas. You talked about getting, cut or fired, with the different amount of imports that are allowed in a league. In the NBA, you kind of get cut if you're not performing. Overseas, you can kind of get cut even when you're playing well. You might just not be a fit. Go talk a little bit about that first, and then let's dig into the economy stuff.
So the terms of like why you might get fired from a job, there's varying reasons. Mine was interesting this year. So I wasn't playing particularly well, and I wasn't shooting the ball as great. I was shooting the ball at about a 36% clip, and I needed to be up closer to 40. Uh-huh. And in terms of the fit for my team and my coach was a little nutty, to say the least. He was a hothead and he was super nervous. And for me as a player, I'm kind of, okay, I'm a vet. We've been around. We had an older team. So what he was saying didn't always make a lot of sense. I'd be like, yo, we can just do it this way. You know, I've worked with coaches a lot and he did not like any of my input or my senior. I had a very veteran point guard, a 33-year-old point guard who had played in EuroLeague. Me and him got into our coach's doghouse very quickly. And so he didn't really like us. And in terms of the fit for a coach, that was why everybody else around the team liked me. My teammates did, all the management did. They saw I was professional. But in terms of a fit for a coach and what he wanted, that was why I got fired. I was still, I was only averaging like 5 or 6 points, but I was only taking 2 or 3 shots.
Yeah.
So for me, it was a fit. And in terms of the style of play that our coach wanted to, and our team was pretty selfish. So, for me, I got fired for a fit, not because I wasn't good enough. Also, there was a secondary reason, which was, we had two American power forwards. We had me and another guy, and he was cheaper is the way it went is they wanted to cut one of us. Mm-hmm. And my contract was bigger than his, so it was actually better for them to cut me because they could save more money and go and pick up a player at the back end.
Yep.
So it was much more almost a financial decision, as well as a head coaching a personality difference between the coach and I.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're getting cut, that's the thing that's always interesting is teams are going to try and remove you for as small amount as possible. So some guys are going to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to get all my money if a team cuts me, which is very unlikely.
Yeah.
What happens a lot of times is you come to a settlement, and it depends league to league and where you're going. Some places try and cut you for no money.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I was in Greece, they were like, all right, we're going to cut Mike. He doesn't get any more money. He gets this month's salary, which he already worked for. And I was like, no. We need to come to some sort of agreement. And every country changes, like I said. It depends if they have a players union, how wealthy the country is or how wealthy the league is. And sometimes it's also like business practices, cultural business practices will dictate how much money you get on your settlements.
Mm-hmm.
So for me in Greece, Greece is a very known place to not pay guys as well as be really late on payments. Thankfully, my team was pretty square up on the financial aspect. So when I was negotiating with them, I had asked for two extra salaries. So wherever I got fired, that date plus two extra salaries, and I would leave immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But I came with stipulations that said I also need to have those two extra salaries in my bank account before I leave the island.
Yep.
Because I don't want to be calling and chasing money. And that's one thing that people need to understand is, as a basketball player, you may have contracts, but teams are shady. Teams don't pay. Teams pay late. And it's just kind of part of being a basketball player. So sometimes you have to chase money of calling your agent, calling teams. Hey, when am I going to get paid? So that happens quite often in the basketball world. And for the normal time of players getting cut, if you get cut from your contract, the normal time is, the normal amount is about 1 month. One extra month you'll get paid, maybe two, depending on the league.
So, you know, I've talked to a ton of guys. Like, this is super common what you're saying. You hear the term FIBA court. You know, you're talking about like different practices from country to country. A lot of stuff, from what I've heard, is very corrupt. Like, nope, we're just not going to pay this guy. Or maybe if Mike doesn't put pressure on us, then we don't have to follow through with this payment. What happens when you don't get paid? Have you ever been stuck in a process like that?
Yeah, it's actually, it happened to me last year. I was playing extremely well in Lithuania. I was one of the top scorers in the league. I think I was first or second in player efficiency rating. Had won player of the week multiple times. And my team wasn't paying me. The first payment and one and a half payments they paid me on time, and then I didn't get paid for 2.5 months. And usually what happens is it's written in your contract. So within your contract, it says if a team doesn't pay you within a certain amount of days, you're allowed to sit out and not participate, which I could have, but I chose not to because I was going to continue playing and hoping to try and get a buyout in my contract, because I had a buyout for my contract. So I was trying to play my way out of this contract. And then what happens is, if they don't pay you and it's past the 30 days, then you sit out. It's hard to sit out sometimes because it puts a bad taste in everybody's mouth.
Yep.
But at the end of the day, it's a business. So you have to be willing to, like, after a while, it's just like, okay, enough's enough. I'm going to sit out. And then there's a break clause, which is, for me, it was 40 days. So if I haven't been paid for 40 days, then the contract is cut and I can leave and go and play wherever I want. And the team owes me the full amount. I would just have to take them to court.
Got it.
So what happens when you go to FIBA court is, there's two sides of it. There's your side and the team's side. And both people, and usually what happens is, if a player wants to take a team to court, he has to pay the team's fee. So usually it's about $3,000 for the player and $3,000 for the team. So it's a total of $6,000 for the player. And so it's really expensive initially to even go to court. And then on top of that, FIBA likes to rule in favor of its teams a lot.
Which makes sense.
And so a lot of times, unless it's very egregious and it's like, no, I just haven't been paid for 6 months, I need my money. Oftentimes they try and find ways around it. So FIBA will be like, oh, you can settle it this much, or they postpone the settlement. So like, they try and make it so they can elongate the process as much as possible to give teams as much time as possible. Plus, it's just a slow process. Every court process is slow. And then once all that happens, whatever the court decides, like if the player wins, they get their money back. If you lose, you don't get that money back. So there's a big risk for the players to go to court. And depending on how much money you have, sometimes it's worth it, sometimes it's not. Also, there's been a lot of times, I've had a few of my teammates and friends have gone through this, teams will go bankrupt.
Yep.
Because they owe too many players.
Yep.
Too much money. And then they'll reopen up as a new team. And therefore, the company you're trying to sue, or the team that you're trying to sue, no longer exists. And you really are kind of stuck with nothing in your hands. Like, oh, all right, I can't do anything.
That is so crazy, because you as a player are focused on building up your brand and your reputability. At the same time, it's a business. I think Jared Bergeron was talking about, you know, we keep bringing Wisconsin guys. I think it was Marcus Landry, who they played together in Italy. And I think Landry wasn't getting paid during the season. And he was like the best player on the team. And he's sitting out of practice and just playing in games. He's like, I'm not practicing because if I get hurt, I know you're going to cut me and you're not going to pay me. So it doesn't make any sense for me to practice and risk that when you're not paying me to begin with. And so to go through all that is got to be crazy.
Yeah, it's super challenging because, like, the other thing is sitting out. You know, it sounds like, oh, you're just not paying me, I'm going to sit out. But that's challenging because you want to play well. Like, it's a team aspect. On top of, like, that's really why you're there. There is no other aspect other than your job that you really want to be there for most places. Not every place. Some places you're like, oh, I'd probably live here if, you know, I did, if I had a different job. But you're there to play basketball. So when you're injured or when you're going through contract negotiations, it's extremely difficult to just be like, meh, I'm going to sit down.
Yep.
All right, I'm done.
No, that makes sense. And two, because you get somewhat of a celebrity status being one of the imports. You're one of the guys that's not around there. The team, the fans follow you. They want to come to watch you play. And you're like, hey, listen, I'm trying to protect myself here. That's got to be really difficult.
Yeah, it's just overall, it's a difficult situation. And that's the thing that's going to be probably become more common as we move forward with what's happening in the world today, because all of these economics of basketball really stem from the world economics. And if you got to think about it, we're, as basketball players, we're entertainment commodities.
Yep.
And that's about it. We're entertainment commodities and we're tax breaks is really what I've thought about. Is a lot of countries, you know, they get sponsorships because teams get sponsorships because they're tax breaks. And it depends on how the laws work with each country. You know, a good example is Lithuania and Latvia. Latvia used to have a very strong basketball culture. And then about 5 years ago, they changed the tax laws. So people no longer got tax breaks for donating to sports teams, which means the entire basketball league has dwindled. The amount of money that's in the league is terrible. And just like the level of play has gone down. And the level of sponsorship has gone down. Whereas in Lithuania, they've increased, it's a very basketball-centric country, they've increased the amount of tax breaks that you get for giving to sports clubs, as well as they have huge media contracts with the number one media provider or number one station in Lithuania. So the league there is actually very well represented in terms of how it's ran and media-wise. It just, teams are having troubles with grabbing money from sponsorships based off of what's been happening in the economy.
No, I think it is crazy to see how this is going to impact basketball as a whole, with European stuff, but also, like, look what the NBA is trying to do right now with the G League. And there's, we've talked about on this podcast before how you're not going to take a G League contract or a training camp contract for $50,000 if you are, you know, can go get a EuroLeague contract. But now, if there's not that money overseas, how does this positively impact the NBA in terms of the G League and the reputability there with the types of players that they get in?
So that's going to be a really interesting influx of talent in the G League. Not that the G League doesn't already have a lot of talent, but it's going to have, you know, from what I understand how the G League works, because it's changed even since I've been a professional. You know, it was the D League before. There was probably, I think, 18 teams when I'd first come out of school. They weren't really affiliated with the NBA programs. And now G League is like, that's the track to get to the NBA. And
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you to be honest, like, if you want to go to the NBA, don't go and play in EuroLeague. Like, yes, EuroLeague, you can do it. It's not that you can't, and they bring guys back and forth all the time. But if you're a younger player coming out of college, yeah, definitely go and grab that G League contract, especially for the first 2 years, because that's when they really want to see those guys play.
Yep.
At least that's kind of what I've felt.
No, I think you're accurate on that. I know there's been quite a few guys that I've talked about that have talked, hey, maybe I go take that G League deal because I can get a 10-day contract. And the 10-day contract doesn't mean that you're going to stick in the NBA. The 10-day contract just makes your reputation overseas look that much more, or your resume look that much more attractive.
Yeah, absolutely. And you get to play at home. Yes. Those are also other advantages. And so, you know, from what we've talked to, especially in the economics of basketball, post-coronavirus, post-pandemic, entering into a pretty big economic depression, it's going to be challenging for guys overseas to make any money. I've talked to my agent, and he said anywhere from, you know, 50 to 60% wage cuts, if not more,
yep,
for EuroLeague players.
Yep.
Which means that is going to be trickling down into a lot of teams and or leagues,
mm-hmm,
might not be available next year.
Yeah.
You know, depending on what economically it looks like, they're not going to be able to put forward a team. And if they do, it's going to be for the bare minimum.
Yep.
You know, historically relevant clubs in Europe, you know, in major countries, they're going to struggle next year to find money. Because it's just not going to be there. A lot of times, so understanding where teams get their money from is, one, they get them from townships and or regions. So regional government gives them, you know, money to have a town, money to have a team, on top of, like, you know, solo or sponsorships from other teams. But the big one is the government. A lot of teams get half their budgets from governments. So, you know, they're not going to get that money next year. So that's going to put a significant impact on budgets across all of basketball, whether it's Asia, Egypt, you know, Asia, Middle East, Europe, and even, you know, I think even down to the G League. Yeah. I think that'll be interesting. Like, I think G League contracts are going to get significantly reduced based off of, you know, what they can, depending on what the collective bargaining agreement looks like in the NBA.
Yeah, I think it's going to be interesting to see how that works. I talked to a guy who's playing in the EuroLeague that he had heard 60 to 70% decrease for next year. You have all of that, the financial kind of wondering of what's going on. And I think the Clippers owner just went and bought the Forum for $400 million cash or something. It's like, hey, we're all going to sit here in quarantine and figure out how to pay our bills, but that's fine. You just go buy the Forum.
This is one of the best venues ever.
I know. We're just gonna, and you know what? We're gonna pay cash. Absolutely crazy. But I think there's a lot of people that, you know, we don't understand kind of those bottom leagues. You think of, hey, you play overseas basketball. There's a lot of guys that are really, really talented players that are making $900 to $1,500 a month. Now they're getting their housing paid for, but some of those lower leagues where guys are making between, you know, say $1,000 to $1,500, $2,000 a month, what's going to happen there?
I mean, I've been in those leagues. I played in those leagues. I've had an interesting career in terms of I started my career at a EuroCup team in Jerusalem, one of the better EuroCup teams in Europe. And then I didn't get to play due to extenuating circumstances, mostly because I wasn't Jewish or Israeli. And so I've seen a lot of those lower level leagues, and they're, you know, some semi-professional leagues, and the bottom level leagues, they really are stressful on budget. You know, and usually it's one or two people that are a secretary. Even my team in Lithuania, which is actually a pretty well-respected league, we had a head coach, we had an assistant coach, a strength coach, and we had one person in the office who was, she's a mom, she's got two kids, she has her own business on the side on top of helping us do everything, getting visas, booking, you know, making sure, you know, games, travel schedules, everything is taken care of through her. So in terms of what's going to happen with teams that are like that, because my team in Lithuania is definitely, there's a lot of teams that are like that. You know, they have one or two people handling these finances and handling everything and getting sponsorships and everything. So their infrastructure is very limited, and a lot of times it's a side hobby.
Yeah, yeah.
So these teams are going to collapse. It's one of those things that's going to happen. You know, Latvia is very specifically, I think it's not going to have a league anymore. It was already struggling financially the last two or three years, and now, like, they're probably not going to have a league anymore. I'd be interested to see if Luxembourg really has a league anymore after this. You know, Macedonia, there's a few of these, you know, kind of off the wall, smaller places that, you know, they just won't have them. And you'll see a lot of secondary leagues drop too. So, you know, in Germany, there's two decent leagues. There's BBL and Pro A.
Yep.
I would say that Pro B is probably going to be one that's dropped.
Yep.
And it'll turn more into like a very, very amateur third division league. You know, same thing in Spain. Spain has three or four different divisions. Those bottom two are definitely going to be removed. Leb Gold, the second division, and the ACB will probably be okay. Same thing in France. You know, I'd say Pro B France, the second division in France actually used to be a pretty desirable job.
Yeah.
And now, after all this, I'm sure it's going to go into much lower wages. You know, you can make $3,000 or $4,000 in France, and I'd be very hard pressed to see if anybody makes more than $2,000 a month next year in Pro B. If even further down, like less.
I think that's crazy to see. I don't know how this impacted those leagues over there, but I know in America, you mentioned kind of your timeline of when the NCAA tournament and everything was getting canceled. The Ivy League shutting down, I think they were the first to shut down their conference tournament. We saw it in Minnesota and across the country with state tournaments. You rent out these big venues, but you have these insurance policies. So everyone's saying, hey, let's just play the games with no fans. Well, then I don't think they're able to collect on these insurance policies, because then they've actually paid. So now you have no fans, you have no source of revenue, and you've rented these massive facilities to run events as the high school leagues have. But the EuroLeague stuff, do you think that there's a chance that some of those leagues maybe have insurance policies that could kind of cover their butts, or are they screwed?
I think they're kind of screwed.
Yeah, I know it's kind of
personally honest
speculation, but.
Nah, but I mean, it is. It's one of those things where, you know, understanding insurance law in different countries always is challenging. But for these venues, you know, teams do rent a lot of their venues. There's only a few teams, you know, there's no teams in the EuroLeague, I think, that owns their own arena.
Got it. That's fascinating. You know, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, you know, there's like, you know, if you look at all the EuroLeague teams, they play in these big venues. I don't know if they own them, they rent them. And, you know, they're kind of, that's their home base, but it's the same concept. So for them, it's going to be difficult. And, you know, for me, it was interesting because when I was going through looking at all this, I figured my Lithuanian league would be canceled the way it was canceled based off of budgets.
Yeah.
And like, you know, teams in Lithuania were really far behind, and they were like, oh, cool, we don't have to pay a contract. Perfect. Let's get out of this. And I think that's been a lot of the ideas of what's happening with these sporting events is it's kind of the same thing. Oh, we probably shouldn't do this, but financially it makes much more sense for us not to do this. Except for the NCAA tournament, you know, in terms of their TV revenue, that was the only thing that was really going to save them.
Yeah.
But everywhere else, it's not really built like that. And especially in these other countries, they're not really dependent on these TV revenues. Such as the United States is. And the other thing too is a lot of these teams are tax evaders.
Yeah.
there's a lot of things that go on with the shadiness that goes on in all these leagues with tax evasion, and it's a good way to kind of clean and launder some money.
Yep, the dark side the dark side of overseas hoops.
I mean, if you want to hear about it, like my team in Greece, I signed two different contracts. I signed a contract that me and my agent have and that the GM has. But then there's like these secondary contracts that they make you sign. And it basically shows like I was supposed to make an allotted amount. My amount was. And they were like, oh, no, you're only going to make like $800 a month and we're going to pay for your housing. And I was like, wait, what? Summation of the contract is like $5,000. I was like, that's completely wrong. And they're like, don't worry, it's for tax purposes.
Perfect.
I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, one of the other things is the team that I played on in Lithuania this year. My head coach's father is somewhat of a gangster. if you know the history of Lithuania, then you'll understand it. They became an independent country in the early 90s, and they had just like kind of the Wild West for like 10 or 10, 15 years because they just didn't have a central government that had a lot of power. And one of the cities is kind of like referred to as like the 1920s version of Prohibition Chicago, called Panavagish. That's where my head coach's father was from. And he is a pretty big time gangster. He also employed my head coach. It's because it was his son. And he was a donor to the team.
Interesting.
So we had all this money going on. First of all, that ensured our head coach could not get fired. But then the second thing was, is they, after the games, if you had the most points or if you had the most rebounds, they would ask you to sign these things and say, you got this player of the game, like you will receive something.
Interesting.
They didn't put like a number of monetary value. Also, they always wanted us to sign extra, like every week. They were like, you guys need to sign this. It's for your food stipend. And I was like, I don't have a food stipend.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm not signing this.
Yeah. I'm sure the store, I've actually heard, you might be able to confirm this, that Pekovic over there is like the head gangster in like Serbia.
Yeah, from where I know, he's like got a few different clubs that he owns. You know, he does his thing.
He does. But
it depends on which part of the world you're in. You know, there's parts of Italy that are ran by the mafia. You know, I've had guys tell me that, you know, they've played in Ukraine and they used to go and get their payments in straight cash out of a garbage bag.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Like they waited out. Yeah. They waited outside of an office and then like the boss man would call you in and here you go. This is your lump sum of your payment. Take it home. Thank you. Like that's how they got paid. You know, there's been some guys that I've talked to that have, you know, got cut by teams and they said, oh, I would like to, you know, please pay me my money. And they were shown a gun.
Oh,
it was, the gun was on the table. They're like, oh, you want your money? Cool. Well, do you want me to use this? No. Okay. Sounds good. Have a good time. We'll buy your flights out tomorrow. Like that's happened before. So
have you seen, are you familiar with Bert Kreischer?
Yes, like, I love Bert. Great guy.
I am the machine.
Yes.
It's like real life. Robbing your classmates on the train.
The Russian train.
With the mafia. That is, yeah. That happens in overseas basketball.
Yeah, it's happened before. There's been some stuff in Russia that's happened before in terms of certain teams are ran by certain people. So, you know, it's a different type of business that most people don't really understand. It's challenging to navigate. Unless you've got some experience in it, and even the experienced guys make mistakes. That's one thing that I can attest to. You know, there's certain times I'm like, man, maybe I shouldn't have signed there. You know, maybe I should have waited something out. You know, there's always, it's a very difficult business to navigate.
Well, I know that you guys in the, you know, towards the end of the summer, we'll be in the gym and guys are talking about like, well, I got this deal. I kind of want to wait for something else, but I'm not sure. It gets really interesting because you just kind of have to guess. I know Ryan Brueggemann this year got to Bosnia and he was like top 10 in the league in scoring and assists. They got a new coach and the new coach just stopped playing him. Like, why? I don't know. Just wants to play the local guys. And so to a lot of people would say, oh, that was a terrible decision to go to Bosnia. But instead it actually got him in the second division of Spain. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh yeah, going somewhere and getting cut was like best case scenario for him to get him into where he was going or where he was looking to go. Do you feel like there are guys over there that can kind of get blackballed in different leagues, or are the clubs, you know, kind of on their own independent? Or
I mean, the way it works is a lot of times, you know, you're always playing for your next job. So the thing about overseas basketball is it's all 1 year contracts. So you're constantly interviewing for your next job. Like that's the best way to describe what you're doing. You're on a constant interview. And, you know, sometimes if you're challenging to work with, like I know guys that have had, you know, problems either, you know, just being not professional, you know, not being, you know, just not being sound of mind and understanding that this is a business and this is an opportunity and this is a job. They're kind of like, oh, I just have to be here.
Yep.
Or just how they play, their playing style, super selfish, you know, stuff like that. That can cause problems for you. And a coach's talk, that's the other thing is if you have a coach that speaks English pretty well and a general manager that speaks English pretty well,
yep,
then they're going to talk. And they're going to be your previous employer. So they're going to talk to you about, you know, who you were going to sign with. And coaches are going to call them and say, oh, how is he? You know, I've had a couple point guards, my point guard from a couple years ago who had played with in Ventsville's the Champions League team. Our coach didn't like him because he was a little older. He gave some more attitude. Like, I liked playing with him. I thought he was a great point guard. He just, you know, our coach tried to murder us on the floor. We'd have like 6 hours of practice a day, and yeah. He was just like, I'm not doing it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he got kind of messed up out of jobs the next season. There was about 4 or 5 jobs that, you know, he was up for, and he never got them. Because he probably what happened was is the general manager and the head coach both kind of talked bad about him and talked down to him to other coaches and other general managers. So that can definitely happen where you get blackballed out of leagues. And in terms of, you know, just coaching style, you know, for me, a good example is this season when I was playing in Greece, every player on my team in Greece liked playing with me way more than they liked playing with the other power forward. Mm-hmm. And it was visibly evident that when I was on the floor, like, things were just much smoother.
Yep.
And my head coach just didn't want to play me. He just didn't like what I was doing. He'd find a lot of ways to just pull me out for no reason. You know, I'd start games and then he wouldn't play me until the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
I'd play the first 7 minutes and then not play until the fourth.
That's crazy. You know, on that topic of like how you play and, at Wisconsin, you kind of became known as not only the guy with the crazy hair. By the way, the cornrows was incredible, that picture.
Oh, yeah.
If you have not seen the Mike Brusewitz, were you in like a Bill Walton, like Blazers jersey?
Yeah, I was. It was after we beat Ohio State.
Yeah, in cornrows. But you were known as like the grinder, the guy who played with a ton of energy, diving on the floor. When I played with you in the summer, going into your sophomore year in the top 100 expo, I think you had 8,000 rebounds in every game.
Probably.
And you're known as like, as that guy who's just flying all over the place. But when you got overseas, they say, hey, you know, we're going to need you to play a little bit more. I don't know if skillfully is the right word.
Yeah. Skillfully and more, it's more of an offensive minded situation, offensive minded player.
Yep. Talk to me a little bit about that experience of going overseas. I know Sanjay Lumpkin, we've talked about this. He was at Northwestern, and they built him up to get him to like 230, 235. And then as soon as he got done, he was like, screw this. I'm going to 200, 205, and I'm going to play like that.
Yeah, that's one of the things that changes is college basketball is very different than professional basketball. And people who are kind of just outside lookers of the game are like, well, what do you mean? Well, the game is faster in professional basketball because there's a shorter shot clock. The athletes, generally speaking, are bigger. Not all leagues, but, you know, generally speaking, as you raise a level, the size changes and the length of players change. So, you know, going from high school to college, that changes. And then going from college to pros, that usually changes as well. And especially as you step up in leagues.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, when I was coming out of Wisconsin, I mean, coming into Wisconsin, like I was known as like a playmaker, you know, throughout high school, like when I was, you know, my junior and senior year, like I was a distributor, like I was a point forward a lot for my teams. You know, especially my senior year, we didn't have a great point guard.
Yeah.
So I was bringing the ball up a lot. And I was, you know, kind of a primary playmaker, could do a lot of different things. I didn't do anything great coming out of high school. I just did a lot of things well. And that was kind of the same thing that happened to me at Wisconsin is I came in and I actually wanted to play the small forward position because I had looked and I was like, oh, there's a person in front of me. His name's Tim Jarmus. I was like, I think I could compete for that spot.
Yep.
In terms of who else I had to compete with was John Luer and Keaton Ankeville.
Yep.
Were at the 4 and the 5. John Luer got drafted and Keaton Ankeville was top 2 or 3 in 3-point field goal percentage his senior year.
Yeah.
In the Big Ten. So it was kind of difficult. And, you know, Jared Bergen was in front of me. There was a lot of guys that were there. And at that small forward spot, I felt like I could kind of get going. But when I showed up, they liked how tough I was. They liked that I could kind of wrestle with bigger guys. Because the Big Ten it's a very different, you know, the Big Ten has always been, especially when I was coming up, was one of the premier conferences, but it was super physical.
Oh, yeah.
You know, dealing with a guy named Derek Nix, Draymond Green, you know, Dallas Lauderdale, there was a lot of really good big guys. And so they did the same thing that they did to Sanjay Lumpkin and me have a very similar story. I got up to like 225, 230, couldn't move, but defensively I was a problem.
Yeah. Take some contact in the post real
well.
Yeah,
like push guys. But, you know, I'd lost a lot of my offensive skills because I put on so much weight. And that's like one of the things that's really interesting now is the game is changing. Guys want to be more fluid and more athletic and much more skilled. And that was one thing that really wasn't pushed for us at Wisconsin. It was more about being physically ready to play defense and play that style of basketball.
Mm-hmm.
And the transition I had as soon as I left college was, oh, I get to play free again? All right, let's go. Like, so for me, it was much easier for me to transition from college top to professionals because I kind of grew up playing that way.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate to play for 43 Hoops and play at Chris Carr's facility. Back in early 2000s, 2005, 2006, I think was the year I went there. But, you know, I was training with like Chris Humphreys and we would play, Chris Humphreys was there, Troy Hudson. We had a guy named, John Thomas was up there. We had a lot of pros that were all up there from European and NBA. So I learned how to play the professional game at a very young age. So that transition back to it, I actually really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Basketball became a lot more fun as a professional. Because it's faster, it's more pick and roll game, it's much shorter possessions, and you always have to attack.
Yep.
You can't just be like, oh, we're going to run three sets like you can in college. So for me, my game changed a lot. I like to be a rebound and push guy. For me, that's what I do a lot of. I'll rebound and take 2-3 dribbles up the floor and kind of start the fast break and find somebody on the wing. And I definitely found my jump shot as I became a pro.
Yep.
Because I just stopped lifting so much weight and I was able to find a jumper. And that's really what I deal with now is I'm a pick and pop four man, a great reversal guy. And in terms of like my IQ, I feel like I'm almost a secondary point guard on the floor right now. And so that's really been my evolution is I don't take as many charges. I still play super hard, but I'm more of a cerebral shooter now than I ever have been.
Well, I know when we play in the Pro-Am in the summer or at my open runs, there is, you know, you play in the Pro-Am with Tyus Jones, and so, you know, you have an NBA point guard there, but there's something to be said about the big that can get the rebound, and instead of having to pivot and take 2 seconds to find the outlet to be able to grab it, throw the dribble out in front, take 2 dribbles, then get it to the point guard and then get to, you know, a drag ball screen or something like that, changes the dynamic of the defense because you didn't stand there and pivot and look for the outlet and allow the defense to get set.
Yeah, it causes a lot of constant pressure on people. And that's really what I like to play is, you know, for me, that's how I like to play. I like to play fast paced. Get up and down. You know, it's funny. I always say if I would have chose another college besides Wisconsin, I had a great time. We won a bunch of games, but I really would have wished I would either went to, you know, a MIAC school or not a MIAC school. What conference is UNI in again?
Oh, Missouri Valley.
Yeah, the Missouri Valley. I would have chose a Missouri Valley school, or possibly a West Coast like Pac-12 school because it's much more closer to the NBA. It's much more up and down. It's much more athletic. You know, the same ACC would have been fun. But it's for me, that's the most fun style of basketball to play because the ball moves, everybody's moving. It's much more interesting than watching, you know, half court basketball, which is, you know, kind of was the norm when I was growing up.
Well, I've had plenty of conversations with guys that struggle to watch college basketball. I'll be honest, I struggle to watch college basketball. I love watching NBA. I love watching those concepts. I have plenty of conversations with Matt Fletcher, who's the head coach at Bethany Lutheran down in Mankato, and is probably going to get a Division II job here soon. But Fletch gets all his stuff. It's all NBA concepts, and you got a lot of college guys that question what he does a little bit. Because it's different, but it's like, man, it's less of running actions. Let's run 17 actions to get a jump shot. And instead, hey, let's maybe run one action to get the matchup that we want. And then we're just going to play out of it. And it's like, oh, hey, imagine that. We got Mike and the point guard matched up offensively against, there's a defensive mismatch. And now we're putting them in a ball screen. Have fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, figure it out. And that's the thing that I would really like to see more of for college players. like, I wish that college players, like, didn't have to be on campus so much. And, you know, especially guys in Minnesota, like, I wish we had more college guys in the program to play with us professionals.
Yeah.
Because one thing I really notice very quickly about the college game is the concept of space. Yep. And where are you being the most useful? Because you see guys all the time just coming in and posting up.
Yeah.
A lot of bigs. So it's just like, I'm going to go post up. Like, why? What are you doing there? Like, go sit 3 feet to the left and you'll be open and you're going to create a much better opportunity for somebody.
Dude, Cole Aldrich is not posting up right now. Why do you think you get to post up right now?
Yeah, like Cole, and he was a lottery pick, you know, consensus All-American type of thing. So for me is, especially as we see the game progress and as I'm getting older and seeing the game progress, is especially at the younger ages, I wish guys would learn more professional concepts.
Yep.
You know, I was very fortunate when I was coming up playing with, you know, playing at 443 Hoops. Anthony Tucker was one of those guys. You know, we were both 43 Hoops guys. And we played with professionals all summer when I was 16. You know, I was playing with Chris Carr, D'Angelo Johnson. Who else? Brendan Smith was in the gym with us. Vincent Greer, Jared Reiner. You know, we had Cameron Taylor would come up to the runs. You know, we had a really good, solid core group of professionals that taught me the game at a different level that most people didn't even understand it at. And for me, I was very fortunate to have that when I was younger. So, you know, I had those concepts going forward. Whereas now we don't really teach those concepts. It's not a normal teaching concept to teach the game at a professional level like your guy down at Bethany Lutheran is. And, yeah. And guys are going to kind of feel like, wait, this is odd. I don't understand it. So why don't we do it like everybody else? But in actuality, he's probably helping them even more than they would know.
Well, I think a lot of times we look at something that's different and we automatically say, oh, that's weird or that's wrong. You know, I do think what I find very fascinating, I like the point that you made about I wish players could be at home more in the summers. Last summer, before everybody got back, we started doing some 3-on-3 stuff. And we went to Bethel. I think it was Brad Davison, Calvin Wishart, Ryan Brueggemann, Tyler Peterson, Cole Aldrich, and Daniel Oturu. And Daniel just declared for the draft. And some, you know, he's all over kind of the first round. I saw one mock draft had him at the 8 overall pick. And he got his butt whooped by Cole. And and Cole wasn't in the greatest shape. Cole was actually, we had just started working out so that he could get back in shape. And I remember Cole blocked a shot. And I think Daniel turned and said, man, he's big as shit. And Ryan Brueggemann, Ryan looked at him like he was the dumbest human being on the planet and said, you are too, man. Daniel's an all-American potentially, has an unbelievable year, but doesn't necessarily understand how to play in situations. And Cole's got a 7'6" wingspan, and Brad Davison got a shot fake up and under, and Cole blocked it off the glass, and Brad hits the deck and looks at me and goes, where the heck did he come from? And I'm like, welcome to the league,
that's
dude.
The difference. Yeah, that's the difference is – you know, you don't understand, like I was talking about earlier, is as you jump levels, size changes, length changes.
Yep.
You know, Daniel's seen, you know, he saw all the top guys in AAU when he was going up. Because I did the same thing. You know, I came up when AAU was still very prominent. And it wasn't quite the same as it was, but it was still super good. And, you know, dealing with those. And then all of a sudden, oh, I have to go and play Chris Humphreys?
Yeah.
Oh, that's different. Yeah. You know, having to deal with Chris Humphreys, having to deal with John Thomas, guys who have played in the NBA. Like, Chris Humphreys is a NBA power forward, and I played against him when I was 16.
Basically, he's a double-double machine.
All the way to 24. And people, like, and I feel like I'm a pretty high-level player, and I was like, I'm not that.
No.
I don't have that. I don't got that. He's just wider. He's super athletic. You know, physically, he had 30 pounds on me, so there would be offensive rebounds. I'd be boxing him out. He'd be like, okay, excuse me, Mike. Yep. I'm going to grab this and dunk this.
Yeah.
Thank you. Like, and I couldn't do anything about it. You know, it's one of those things, man, is as you go up in level, it's difficult. And the more situations you can be like that, like you said, with Daniel Oturu is a perfect example, is he wouldn't have got that at the University of Minnesota.
Yep.
They don't have a Cole Aldrich there. They don't have that there. But, you know, in terms of what we have in Minnesota, and every state has this, you know, I've played enough with enough guys around, like every state has, you know, every big city has their pros that they have runs at. And sometimes we, you know, they don't really always invite younger guys.
Yep.
It depends on where you are. Sometimes it's pretty select, where I think for us in Minnesota, you've done an absolutely phenomenal job of putting these runs together and adding so much depth of who comes.
Yeah.
You know, for me, everybody as a pro level really wants to play with other pros, but I think it's even more important for us to have those college guys come in when they're back around, and those high school guys come in and say like, oh, this is what the pro game looks like.
Yep.
Got it. You know, cause we still play, like, you know, we had a lot of concepts this summer of, hey, I'm a professional big man. Another guy's guarding me as a college guy. And all of a sudden it's me and Tyus coming off a ball screen. Who else? Like, we understand how to read that, and they got to figure out how to play defense against that. And you don't always see that in, you know, your college matchups or your college gyms, because you understand your concepts there and you see those guys in practice every day, but you don't get the, you know, that effect of seeing everything and how they're going to handle it once they see somebody bigger or better than them.
Well, I think the concept of if you're the best player in your gym, you need to find a new gym.
Yeah.
Daniel was the best player for the Gophers. He's arguably, you know, with Garza, at the big dude at Iowa, he might have been actually one of the best players in the Big Ten. And so you got to find a different gym. And that's where, in order to improve at those aspects, and that's where coming and playing against Cole was great. I saw how many times where Cole would stop somebody, or you would stop somebody, like, hold up. Let's talk about this situation real quickly here. We can't handle it that way. I got video clips of guys talking and going through that stuff, whether it was, you know, you, Tyus, Cole, Jake Lehman, trying to be mentors. Because I know that you guys look back and say, hey, Chris Carr, Chris Humphreys, John Thomas, all those guys, they gave so much to me. How can I give that back to some of these young kids so that they can have some success? Because in all honesty, you have Trey Jones, McKinley Wright, and potentially Tyrell Terry, three point guards from Minnesota the last 3 years that are declaring for the NBA draft this year, right? We have
Tyrell Terry declared too?
Potentially. So,
okay.
So you have that. You have Matthew Hurt. You have Zeke Nnaji. I mean, like, look at the people. Obviously, we just talked about Oturu. Look at the people from the state of Minnesota. McKinley Wright has been awesome at Colorado. We have some talent, and so to have that ability to mentor those guys in the summer. I had a college coach last year tell one of his guys, hey, you don't need to come back this summer very much. I want you to stay at home because I know you're going to work out with Reed, and I know you're going to be in runs, and you're going to have to guard Tyus Jones. I know you're going to have to guard Anthony Tucker, and that's gonna be the best thing for you heading into your senior year. And he had a great senior year.
Yeah, and that's the case, man, is one thing that, you know, you've done a great job of in terms of just promoting all the runs that we've had, because we kind of missed that for a few years. You know, I was out of town. I was, you know, doing some other stuff, and a lot of people weren't. We never really quite got centralized of how we wanted to operate this network of yep. pros and trainers. But you know, this summer, hopefully, you know, depending on what's going to happen this summer, if we can have guys play, man. Or if not, this is the big unknown for me. Cause I really enjoyed all that stuff. You know, for me, that was really fun of coming to open gym, and you know, I love getting your text to say, hey, we have a run here. And it was your concept of, I never want to have to ask who's there.
It works
perfect for me. I loved that idea. Cause that's always how it was for me. And it was for a lot of people, who's there. You know, is it going to be worth my time, or is it going to be kind of some, you know, some BS? So it's going to be interesting to see what happens going forward. You know, I talked to Jamar Diggs a couple months ago, about a month and a half ago. You know, we were fully planning on putting together the Pro-Am. I'm trying to do some stuff with that for some educational pieces with that. But on top of, you know, trying to bring, just bring more of the youth aspect to the Pro-Am to try and help them learn about the professional game and everything like that. But now it's kind of all up in the air, man.
Everybody keeps asking me, when are we going to be able to start training? I'm like, Dr. Fauci doesn't know when we're going to be able to start doing stuff. You think I got answers, dude?
I don't know. Do you think when can you go get a normal cup of coffee with one other person?
Dude.
And then multiply that by five, and then we'll maybe start being able to play again.
Well, yeah, and they're like, oh, large groups. You can't do anything with groups of 10. I'm like, well, do I have to be?
I make 11.
Yeah, do I have to? Yeah, does that mean I got to play? Shoot, we're screwed, man. Oh,
I think everybody's screwed in terms of playing, because I went to a court outside yesterday, kind of in a park. Oh, man, I was winded for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I did a simple one dribble shooting drill. Didn't even do much. Just grab it, rebound, shoot, turn. Baseline to baseline. Ooh. Full sweat.
It is.
Full sweat after 10 minutes.
It is crazy to see, even for high level athletes, how quickly it goes. Last year when Amir Coffey, right before he declared for the draft, the Gophers lost in the national tournament, and he took a week off, which I thought was awesome. Take the week off, get your legs back, and then we're going to go hard. And our first workout at McAllister, we're about 5 minutes. I'm like, dude, we're like in a warm up. You're like, and he's got his hands on his knees. He looked at me. He goes, dude, I had no idea how quickly my lungs went. Now, it took him about 3 days to get it back, but it's like, oh, you go hard for, you know, an entire year, take a week off. It's like, man, where did it
completely different?
Where did my, he was looking at me. He's like, dude, I'm embarrassed myself. I'm like, no, you're good.
I agree with him. I already know. And that's going to be the interesting thing, is people are talking about if this blows over, you know, do we continue the NBA season? And there's no way.
Yeah, it's going to
there's
be.
There's no way.
Yeah, I think.
I don't care how disciplined you are and how much you're doing. Like, if you're forced to be this sedentary, you know, you can't be that active the whole time. Even if you have a court in your house, like, you can really only practice by yourself for, you know, 2 hours.
Yeah.
You know, it's not game shape. And especially at game pace, like, they've been off for a month now, or, you know, 2.5 weeks. They're going to be off for a full month. That's not going to happen.
Do the Nets have, if they do come back, can the Nets get Durant healthy in time? That's what I heard the other day. It was like, oh yeah, Kyrie Irving and Kevin Durant out for the year. Unless the year goes to September.
Then if it goes into September, then we're good.
Yeah, the Warriors are going to get Steph and Klay back. They're going to, they got, what do they got? 30 games left. It's like, oh, they're probably still not. What if the Warriors get an 8 seed because they get everybody healthy?
And they just go on like a 28-2 run.
Oh,
just something scary.
That is crazy. Well, as we kind of wrap this up, I do have some segments, and I do enjoy these, and I think you'd have some good answers. I know you went to Wisconsin, but we do a segment, your favorite or your most memorable, heart-wrenching Minnesota sports fan moment, because we all have a moment that's just broken our, just shattered our hearts. What's your Minnesota moment?
It was when the Timberwolves lost to the Lakers in the Western Conference Finals.
What year was that again?
It was 2003.
So how old were you?
Or no, 2004, 2005, I think it was. My brother had just graduated from high school.
Yeah.
I think it was 04.
You're about 12, 13. Anthony Peeler. I love that dude.
Anthony Peeler was bricking threes.
Dude, he was left-handed.
In game four.
I was like,
dude, Anthony Peeler, you need to hit some shots. Like, what are you doing here, guy? Anthony, you're killing us.
What, didn't he switch his number from, like, number 1 to number 44? It was, like, the most random number change of all time.
I don't know. Him missing all those threes, like, who we had. Trenton Hassel was bricking threes.
Oh,
it was
Trenton
bad.
Hassel.
Like, Sprewell was doing okay. Cassell was holding his own. You know, Sprewell had Kobe, so I was like, all right, you know what? We're gonna call that anything negative. Like, just negate the negatives.
The negative.
You know, the Sprewell, they're like, what, you're going to ask Latrell Sprewell to go at vintage Kobe? Like, no, that's not it.
Good Latrell Sprewell story, like, and it's terrible because I think he went bankrupt, but someone said that they seized his, like, $8 million yacht in Milwaukee. Who's got an $8 million yacht in Milwaukee?
Latrell Sprewell does.
It was like, what?
Man,
he's
the man who had a great number of investments that all worked out for him.
Dude, you remember the Sprewell, the dad? Oh, Thank you.
The spinners. Everybody loved them. I was in seventh grade.
Yeah,
it was amazing.
Until you
it was took, right around that same time.
Yeah, you took two steps and then the spinners quit spinning. So then you just had rims.
Or they would pop.
Yes.
The other one is they would pop off. I had a couple games stopped because they would pop off.
Oh, man. So the podcast is referred to as back or the drawing board. So this idea that when things aren't going the way they're planned, which is very much present right now, you know, you have to go back to the drawing board. Kind of what is your process? I know you basically have talked a little bit about what you're doing in this quarantine, but when you have to kind of audit yourself and go back to the drawing board, how do you go about that?
For right now, it's I'm just trying to mentally stay as positive as I can because it's interesting. Everybody's in this situation. You know, a lot of people have lost their jobs. You know, the strange thing is for me is I lost my job.
Yeah.
My season got canceled, but that's also my source of income. So for me right now, I'm going to the drawing board of, you know, what's next for me outside of basketball on top of what's next for me in these next 3 to 4 months.
Yeah.
Because I still plan on playing, but I also know that I'm probably going to be playing at a very reduced price next summer or next fall. So I'm also kind of looking at it like, all right, financially, I'm going to have to steady the boat here and figure it out. And, I think it'll be an interesting summer for me. The drawing board is going to be, all right, what does life look like without basketball for me?
Yep.
And I've done a pretty good job so far of going through this. You know, I've had odd jobs throughout the summer. I've worked for one of my best friend's companies doing estate sales and franchising concepts. So I have, you know, some ideas about what I want to do. But this summer, and it's not even summer, you know, this next spring.
Yeah,
because this is the earliest I've been home.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I got to stay afloat for a while and I've done good job of saving money and everything, but it's now the drawing board is what's basketball not look like, you know, what's basketball look like, or what's my life look like without basketball. And then in terms of the basketball, I have the drawing board, you know, I have the blueprint for what my summer is going to look like, depending on how much access I'm allowed to having large groups and everything, you know, but for me, it was playing the pro-am, playing summer runs with you, work out with you and work out with JD Jones again.
Yep.
I spent a lot of summer time with JD last summer, which was great.
Yep.
So, you know, I kind of have that and do some traveling. But for now, that's the drawing board. And then in terms of, you know, handling life without basketball, it's going to be weird.
Yep.
I've come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
It's going to be strange because we're not going to have basketball for a while.
No, I think the goofiest part, I've tweeted it. You see all these kids doing workouts. I've been putting workouts. One of my good buddies, Shane Hennon's putting them out. Bergeron's putting them out. Kids are doing Mikens, and they're excited. I'd
love to see it.
I have never seen so many kids so excited to do the Miken drill because their season just got taken away from them. And, you know, as cliche as it is, you don't know what you got till it's gone. It has been taken away, not just from you, but from everybody. And that, to me, is the weirdest thing about this because it's like, hold up. It's not like I just tore my ACL and my season ended. It was like, we all just did that. And
everybody's stopped.
Yeah, that, to me, is the goofiest.
Yeah, and that is a goofy thing for everybody. And in terms of, you know, for guys who are coming back from overseas, I have a weird period for like the first week or two where I'm like, oh right, I'm home now, like this is strange, like, you know, you know, not only did I lose my job, but I also had to change environments. It's a comfortable one, but it's one that I haven't seen for 8 or 9 months now, so I'm kind of like, oh
yeah,
this is odd, you know. I'm back home, I can get peanut butter M&Ms, and the person talking in the grocery store next to me speaks English. Oh, okay, this works. You know, there's some weird adjustments that I always have coming home from places, because, you know, there's, as much as everybody says, is, you know, it's nice to always come back home. Like, man, those first 2 weeks are strange because you just got to readjust your body, readjust your time zones, you know, get used to being like, oh yeah, there is an everything store. Target's down the street. This is great.
Oh man. No, I'm with you. I think this is a crazy, crazy time, but it's my hope that we can learn from this. I know that seems really cliche, but my wife and I've had a lot of awesome conversations about what we can do, how we can try to remain positive, and what we can try to to get out of this. So Mike, you know, I appreciate your insight. I wish you the best. If this were any other year, I'm sure we would have already grabbed lunch or coffee or been in the gym.
We would have. I would have. You were one of the first people I texted like a couple days back. I was like, "Read them back. What's up?
What's up?" Yeah, you called me at like 8:45 in the morning, and I was like, "Yeah, I'm up. I'm up."
I saw your Twitter. I saw you tweeted something. You did something on social media. I was like, "He's awake.
He's awake, dude. Dude, I'm so amped up. I woke up this morning at like 4:15." Just ready for the day.
I saw.
Why? I woke up. My wife walks into the office and she goes, "What are you doing?" I was like, "Whoa. I have no idea." But we're rolling.
You're gonna have to show Amanda the picture I sent you. I'm curious what her thoughts are.
She saw you in the Skyway, I think, with PJ Hill last year.
Yeah, and I gave her a big hug.
Yeah, and she was like, "I saw Mikey B." Mikey B, you are the fan favorite. But I appreciate you, man. We will talk soon.
All right, sounds good. Thanks, Reed.
That was Mike Brusewitz. I knew that bringing Mike on, he'd have some fascinating takes on overseas life and the current state of basketball. So I want to thank him for coming on. You know, a lot of coaches, like we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, are looking or reaching out for resources. There's a ton of free resources out there. You can follow me on Twitter. That's at Reed, OCREIDOUSE. Jared Bergren is putting a lot of stuff out at JBergren40. And then Shane Hennen is doing an absolutely unbelievable job at Hennen_workouts, HENNEN_workouts. Putting out a lot of free content. If you have questions, if you're a coach, if you're a player, let us know. Coaches, we would love to connect with your programs and find ways to help during this time. Players, if you have questions on workouts, again, now is the opportunity that you have to not only reach out and ask questions, but use this time to get better. So I want to thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, which I assume that you do because you've gotten to this point, subscribe, give us a rating, let us know what you think. We'll see you next week.